Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. I'm now doing many of these interviews from home, so you might hear the occasional cell phone ding, a door close, a cat's meow. We appreciate your patience. Dr. Lynette Fraga, Executive Director of Child Care Aware of America, joins us from Washington. Thanks for being with us, Lynette.
Thank you so much for having me.
And, of course, we're in the midst of quite a crisis like nothing any of us has really experienced ever before. Parents in particular, what do they need to know about child care during this situation?
Well, first, parents already know what communities need to know even better, and that is that child care is essential. Child care is an essential service, and it is so critically important, particularly during the time we're in right now, the very challenging time we're in right now, and particularly for essential workers, that we take care of both our providers as well as our parents that work in these sectors that we need in order to get through this difficult time.
This thing hit us out of the blue, and I'm sure that demand for childcare services must have soared immediately after the shutdown orders began and people began isolating themselves at home. What does it look like? How much demand is there now for childcare services?
Sure. So 23 million children under the age 6 live in the United States, and about 15 million of those children need care. Imagine adding the number of school-age children that may be out of school now. So there is a high number of children who have both parents in the workforce, and they need care and support. Actually, right now, what we're really focusing on is the number of children, for example, of healthcare workers. So if we just take healthcare workers specifically, 3.5 million children in the United States are children of healthcare workers that may need childcare. And that's not including all of our other essential workers, like our grocery workers and our pharmacists and our first responders. So there is a tremendous need for quality and supportive and healthy childcare right now.
And how about the child care providers themselves? They must be overwhelmed. How are they handling the situation?
I actually just heard from a child care provider earlier this week who provides care in her home. And amazingly to me, a wonderful hero, truly, who is so eager to support and provide care to essential workers. However, she needs help and she needs support, and the kind of help that comes by way of making sure she has the sanitizing equipment that she needs, that she has the kinds of equipment that's necessary and supplies that are necessary to keep her child care home safe and healthy for the children in her care. She also needs things like training and health care consultation to her child care program, ensuring that she has the kind of infrastructure and supports and that are needed, and also trying to figure out, given likely for most childcare programs, their adult child ratios and group sizes that we've heard a lot about lately have to be smaller. And so how do we make up that gap between what was happening before the pandemic and now, and the additional expense that childcare providers have to incur in order to stay open? And those that may have to close, they also need help. Because we need to make sure that we're keeping them whole. They're small businesses. Some of them have staff that they're trying to support, et cetera. And so we really need to make sure that regardless of whether they're providing care or not providing care, that they are supported so that when this pandemic subsides, that childcare is available for our workforce.
Lynette, some states are going ahead and granting emergency child care licenses to providers that previously were not licensed for child care. And this flies in the face of some hard-won regulations that were meant to protect children. Are there concerns that the genie may be let out of the bottle and it will be difficult to return to the status quo?
though these are unprecedented times, and they are, and we have to get creative and ensure that we're being supportive of our parents and our families and our communities, we do need to ensure that as we're thinking about problem solving around availability and accessibility of childcare, that we need to make sure that children are safe, healthy, and supported by these amazing childcare workers that are trained in safety and health protocols, that do have child development training and so forth. So we do want to ensure that as we're moving forward through this time, that we are keeping ourselves accountable to what we know is best for children and families.
What are you hearing from childcare providers about how they're managing social distancing among children, for example, during this time?
So fortunately, the Centers for Disease Control did put out guidelines for childcare specifically. And so like all of us who move day to day, as things are changing so rapidly in our country in so many ways, we really do lean on our public health colleagues and our experts in places like the Centers for Disease Control to help the field think about how they can manage through this epidemic and pandemic in such a way that keeps children safe and keeps communities safe and healthy. So I would encourage folks to visit our website at childcareaware.org. And on that website, there's information about coronavirus and providing care for children, considerations that providers may need to keep in mind if they are able to provide that care, and information like the CDC guidelines, in addition to information for parents about what they need to think about, as well as they try to make the best, most informed choices that they can around providing care for their children.
There is new federal legislation that includes $3.5 billion in additional child care funding to states through the Child Care and Development Block Grant. Is that enough?
$3.5 billion is certainly something that we consider a down payment on what's needed for child care moving forward of this in this time. However, it is not enough. We actually estimate the community of child care advocates really does consider and is estimating the need at $50 billion to ensure that the child care system remains whole, parents and providers are able to be supported and able to access and afford the care that they need during this pandemic, and also ensuring, remember, when we all do go back to work and the pandemic subsides, we need child care to go back to. And if we don't take care of our child care providers today, and those child care businesses don't survive through the pandemic, there will be nowhere for the workforce to have their children cared for after the pandemic. And that is also a real concern.
Dr. Fraga, I understand that your organization, Child Care Aware, is a national organization, but can you tell us what you're doing for families here in Kentucky?
Yes, we are a national organization of child care resource and referral agencies, over 400 of them actually, that are at the state and the local level. So there are child care resource and referral agencies in Kentucky. And how we support those organizations, those child care resource and referral organizations, is by providing information and resources for them, and also making sure that when individual parents or providers come to the national organization and want resources and information, that we also provide that resource and information not only for the child care resource and referral agencies, but also ensure that we are what we call giving a warm handoff to our colleagues in Kentucky so that they can also support parents in their community. We do have state-by-state information during this particular time on our website that will help parents and providers to see what's happening in the state of Kentucky as well. And the map that I mentioned earlier, the number that I mentioned earlier in terms of 3.5 million children of healthcare workers needing child care, that map that was developed by professors at Yale University can be found on our website as well. And you can actually look in Kentucky and see exactly what's happening with healthcare providers in terms of their child, the number of children of healthcare workers. And for planners, that's really important to understand the need.
Okay, that's great. In just a moment, we're going to be talking with Dr. Terry Brooks of Kentucky Child Advocates to kind of bring it down to ground level. And so those maps will be very helpful. One more time, Lynette, where can people learn more about child care right now?
You can go to, if people want to know more, either provider or parent or a planner, they can go to childcareaware.org.
Dr. Lynette Fraca, Executive Director of Child Care Aware of America. She spoke with us from Washington. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
With us now to bring home the coronavirus impact on child care is Dr. Terry Brooks, Executive Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates. Thanks for joining us, Terry.
Hey, Tom, thank you for being here, and thanks for the voice that you're given in the midst of this unusual time. It's such an important time to have folks like you weigh in.
Well, thank you. We're doing the best we can, and we're being told, all of us, with good reason, to stay away from each other. So if you could give us kind of a general sense of how that has affected child care in Kentucky.
Well, I think there's two levels of that. At a macro level, just the whole notion of isolation, separation and distancing brings so many dynamics. We know, for instance, that connection is important for all of us, especially young children and adolescents. So beyond the day-to-day details, I think we all have to sort of wrestle with the impact of what this kind of world means to kids in terms of trauma and in terms of building resiliency. And maybe we can circle back to that. Mm-hmm. But my sense is that you want to drill down on childcare specifically. That is a huge issue in Kentucky. We know that that on March 20th, every child care center in Kentucky closed for the foreseeable future to limit the spread of the COVID-19 situations. We know there are now exceptions where centers that are serving healthcare workers and other essential personnel, like grocery and emergency service workers, are in operation. We do know that Kentucky, I believe that the governor and the cabinet have done an exemplary job of figuring out how to manage what has to be versus the ideal. Kentucky, for instance, has expanded child care options in what is called limited duration centers, which really are emergency approved centers. And so what I think the governor has done very artfully is, in general, child care, just like K-12 schools, is not available. However, we can't say to emergency workers, first responders, medical professionals, and grocery workers, we have to have you on the front line, but we can't support your kids. So there are exceptions to that. What that means for so many folks is you're sheltered in place, and so is your 3- and 4-year-old, because there's nowhere to take them. Certainly, that has long-term implications in terms of the future of childcare in Kentucky when this pandemic ends. But again, right now for your listeners, the general gestalt is there is no childcare services. The caveat is for designated workforce folks, mm-hmm. for those frontline people, there have been emergency and exceptions made. Again, I think in general, the state has responded with real thoughtfulness and intentionality to what we all know is a very, very difficult, unprecedented situation.
Well, Terry, we see some states granting emergency child care licenses to providers that before were not licensed for child care. Is that happening here in Kentucky? Are there concerns about that?
The good news is that all of those LDCs, the limited centers throughout Kentucky, were previously licensed or certified. So in Kentucky, unlike some other states, as you mentioned, in Kentucky, at the moment, we can have good confidence that there is quality, that there is regulatory compliance, that child safety is being guaranteed. Now, you know, I don't know the future, and I don't know as this pandemic expands, what we may be looking at around new emergency approved child care centers. I would hope, and everything we see from the governor, Secretary Friedlander, other key players would say that they are all about quality assurance for kids. And so we have a lot of confidence that if additional centers are approved on a limited or emergency basis, that those safeguards are in place. I do think that that's one of the blessings right now in Kentucky we have. I know that colleagues of mine in other states are deeply concerned that some less than high quality, maybe less than safe centers are in operation on an emergency basis. It's important for listeners to know that is not the Kentucky situation. The centers that are allowed to operate currently, we believe, are high quality, high fidelity to child safety. So that's a positive we can take from where Kentucky sits right now.
Good to hear. Okay, Congress has passed and the president has signed a couple of pieces of legislation in response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Right.
And the potential impacts of the legislation, the impacts are extensive. They include health care coverage, schools, nutrition assistance, family finances. And, of course, we won't be able to cover all of those items here. You can find complete details about them online at your website, Terry, kyyouth.org, or on the facts and information page of our site, esweku.org. Our focus today, of course, is on child care. Let's look first at some highlights of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. What does it do?
Sure. The Families First Coronavirus Response Act, first of all, provides free COVID-19 testing, paid sick leave, unemployment support, and nutritional assistance. And let me just, as you mentioned, details are available both on your website and ours, but sort of that headline view, what I would say is first of all, that cost sharing for the testing is really targeted toward low income, rural, in urban areas. It will help on Medicaid, K-CHIP, uninsured families. That federal action really follows what Governor Beshear had already initiated earlier this month at a state level. We also feel really good about the Family First Response Act because it increases flexibility on nutritional assistance. I think you see almost every day in Governor Beshear's press conference some allusion to the really hard work that public schools, community ministries, and other nonprofits are doing around providing nutrition and meals for little boys and little girls. This act helped deepen and expand that kind of support. Additionally, that act expanded the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. That's the old food stamp program. So at a very basic level, what that act did was made sure that kids have food. That can't be, you know, minimized. Additionally, it really took some positive steps around paid sick leave. Again, lots of details are on our website, but fundamentally, what it means is that moms and dads who are sick, who are experiencing COVID-19 related symptoms, they are going to get economic supports beyond what they normally would. Additionally, it expanded, as we know, unemployment insurance. So really, that act is profound that it positively impacted families around healthcare. It positively impacted families around children's nutrition, and it positively impacted families around economic security. So it was a big deal. It was a beginning step, and we really appreciate what families are benefiting from that D.C. action.
The second piece of legislation is called the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, or CARES Act. And this is the one with the $2 trillion price tag, the one with the one-time checks to most Americans, the special loan program for small businesses, a loan fund for big corporations, and critical support to health services. What inside that act can we narrow down to child care?
Well, the bottom line of the bottom line is that the Child Care Development Block Grant, the acronym CCDBG is what folks will hear on newscast. Kentucky received an additional $65 million to support child care facilities. That is really important. We just had finished talking about how emergency kind of child care centers are working to help healthcare employees and other essential workers have their kids cared for without regard to income levels. We talked about how it has allowed child care centers to provide assistance during the pandemic. We've talked about the need for increased child care support assistance for those emergency workers. That's the kind of focus that block grant is being used for in Kentucky. The good news is that Kentucky Child Care Centers received that $65 million. The bad news is that it is spitting in the ocean. As you have mentioned in your preface, this issue of child care, you can't talk about a thoughtful response to the pandemic with healthcare workers, with first responders, with frontline workers and heroes like grocery workers, without continuing to talk about child care. So the CARES Act certainly is an important first step, very important, but it is not sufficient if we're going to continue this trajectory over time.
Terry, we have just a little bit of time left, and I want to turn to this. And just wondering what you've heard in your role. Is this prolonged home confinement of entire families, which can lead to annoyance at best, irritation, even a toxic atmosphere after a while? Are you hearing that this is translating in some cases into an increase in abusive behavior?
That is the $64,000 question. And I, in no way, Tom, do I want to be hyperbolic, but it scares me to death. I frankly received a press inquiry a week ago, and they had heard that the child abuse hotline was just going off the hook, you know, too much wait time, et cetera. In investigating that and working with the cabinet, we found something that was actually more worrisome. And that is that there had been a dramatic decrease in calls. Well, that is the proverbial canary in the coal mine, because in no way would any rational person believe that Kentucky, the state that leads the nation in the rate of abuse and neglect, suddenly has gotten religion and kids are not being mistreated. Instead, what it suggests is that when public schools were the leading reporter of suspected abuse, suddenly there are no eyes on kids, and that source is gone. The second most frequent reporting agency were child care centers. Well, we've already talked about that entity is largely gone. So suddenly we're in a world in which there are no independent external eyes on kids. And we know that this is a very vulnerable time for moms and dads. My heavens, the pressures and stresses that families are under are unprecedented. So I think the challenge is, can we utilize every role within the community, law enforcement, family resource center folks, food distribution sites, health providers, faith communities, can we do some kind of check-ins, visual check-ins through technology? How can we as a state ensure that we get eyes on kids? There are efforts, COSARE Charities, Face It Movement is really thinking creatively in every region of the state how we can get eyes on kids. I'm so proud of some nonprofit colleagues who are figuring out ways to literally make checks on kids. Maybe that's knocking on a window literally and seeing that kid visually. But your question is so profound, and that is that we as a state have this just potential tragedy waiting to happen, and we haven't quite figured out a systemic way to check on kids during this time. So that is as important of an issue. The governor very heartfully, I think, has said that he does recognize the challenge that DCBS workers are, you know, not making those home visits. And we have got to be creative. We've got to be intentional and figure out ways to do this, or the pandemic crisis is going to pale in comparison to the child abuse situation.
Mm. This is such heavy stuff, Terry. It's a lot to digest. And I'm wondering if in the midst of it all, if you've had time to think about how this whole experience could end up somehow being positive in some respects.
Yeah, you know, I read a piece that's really out of my faith tradition, and it challenged folks to think about not social distancing, but social spaciousness. That's such an interesting word, spaciousness. And the author was contending that maybe, just maybe, the spaciousness of the moment would allow, for instance, families to deepen connections, to really figure out the world we live in frequently is so hectic in pace that we don't make those relationships and connections with our own family. Well, we frankly don't have any choice right now but to deepen those connections. The author was speculating about that. The author was speculating about just the pace that we all live in. And those, you know, I realize at the moment we're in the throes of issues around fatalities and ventilators and economic existence. So I don't want to sound naive. I don't want to sound Pollyannish. But I do think your question is important. We as a people, we as families, and we as individuals have to draw some good from every situation. And so my hope would be that at the end of the day, that concept of family, what it means at a bone deep level, may have ironically been strengthened and deepened because of the crisis that we're all experiencing.
Dr. Terry Brooks, Executive Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates. Thanks so much, Terry.
Tom, thanks for your work. And again, I just want to salute you and underscore how important your voice is during this unprecedented time. Thanks for all you're doing.
Well, thank you very much. WEKU is now providing a daily 10-minute coronavirus update. Hosted by Kelly McEvers, NPR's Coronavirus Daily podcast is available at weku.org. And you look for the blue coronavirus link, click the Listen Now tab, and you can hear the latest stories. The program is available wherever you listen to podcasts and at weku.org. Coming up after the break, we recently featured an interview about force majeure, the clause in contracts that acknowledges failure to perform or pay during such things as a coronavirus pandemic. In that conversation with Lexington attorney Steve Amato, the focus was on the hospitality industry. This time, force majeure in commercial real estate.
A very sophisticated landlord will basically expressly state in a force majeure clause that it does not excuse the tenant's payment of rent under any circumstances.
Lexington real estate attorney Dan Rose will walk us through the thickets of legalese pertaining to the sudden inability to meet contractual obligations. And a decade after it happened, a play about one of the deadliest coal mining disasters in modern history, the explosion at West Virginia's Upper Big Branch Mine. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We've talked about force majeure on Eastern Standard. Lexington attorney Steve Amato joined us a couple of weeks ago to discuss how this often ignored clause in contracts has hit the hospitality industry since the rise of the coronavirus. And from that discussion, it was clear that the clause appears in agreements up and down the general supply chain in the American economy. This week, how force majeure applies in real estate contracts. Joining us is Dan Rose of the Lexington firm Rose, Grash, Kaminish, and Mains. Dan's practice areas include real estate law and real estate litigation, as well as corporate law, mergers and acquisitions law, and securities capital markets law. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Pleasure to be here, Tom. Thank you.
And first, just a definition for those who might have missed our previous discussion about it. What is force majeure?
Well, force majeure is just the French words for superior force. In the legal context, it just means something that has impacted the party's performance under a contract or the party's obligations or the general conditions under which a contract is to be performed. And in the present-day context, the force majeure would be conceivably both the occurrence of the virus and the pandemic across the world and across the United States. But it also could include these government edicts where people are basically have been forced to close their business or curtail their operations. So in the context that we're talking about, it could be both the virus itself and the pandemic or the government response to that.
Okay. And is force majeure a common feature of leases, rental agreements, and other kinds of real estate instruments?
I would say there probably is no hard and fast rule. If you look at most residential leases, you probably are not going to find that in a residential lease. It's something that, in fact, I've taken a look at various leases that I've been involved in reviewing or drafting. And in the residential context, apartments, houses, any kind of residential setting, it's probably not included. However, in the commercial context, most sophisticated landlords, in particular on the landlord side, will include some concept of force majeure or some clause in the contract dealing with force majeure. And specifically, a very sophisticated landlord will basically expressly state in a force majeure clause that it does not excuse the tenant's payment of rent under any circumstances. And in most cases, and I've reviewed several commercial leases over the last few weeks. Most of them, because they're primarily drafted by landlords in that setting, generally will excuse the performance by the landlord under a force majeure event, but they generally don't even talk about any performance by the tenant other than to expressly state that the tenant is not excused from paying rent in the event of a force majeure.
Okay, and following the thread further, what about the relationship between landlord, property owner, and the mortgage company or the bank that that person is financing the property through?
In those settings, there really is no relief at all for the property owner because, again, the contract that is in play in that situation is basically the loan documents. And I've drafted, represented many lenders in loan transactions, and you would never find any kind of a force majeure clause in any type of a loan document. And again, it really gets back to who puts those documents together. And just like in the context of a commercial lease where it's basically the landlord's form and is drafted generally to favor the landlord, again, in a loan setting, there is no relief that's included for the benefit of the lender in the event of a force majeure. And in most situations, and the cases that I've reviewed, the force majeure, again, it's only something that would make performance impossible. And in the setting of a contract where one party is basically just obligated to pay money, like a commercial tenant or a borrower under a loan agreement, the force majeure event does not in and of itself prevent them from paying the money. Now, it might impact the economic viability of their business, or it might make it more difficult for them to get the money together to pay, but in and of itself, a force majeure event does not prevent them from making the payment. And the courts have construed these clauses very strictly to where if they don't clearly excuse performance, then a party is not excused from performance. Now, there's one setting that there's some other legal doctrines that apply here that relate to force majeure. There's the doctrine of impossibility of performance. It's also called sometimes impracticability of performance or frustration of purpose of a contract. And that's a situation where parties have entered into a contract under certain assumptions, and then one of the underlying assumptions of the contract that neither party has any control of and neither party had any way to foresee has really rendered the value of that contract to one party or the other just worthless. So, for example, in this commercial, in the setting we're in now, I've got some clients who, as a result of this edict from the governor, and it's true in other states, they've been forced to basically cease operations. So they can't even operate their business at all. And in those situations where there is no force majeure clause in the contract, such that the parties can then try to rely upon these common law doctrines, because the courts have said that if a contract does include a force majeure clause, then generally you can't fall back on the common law doctrines I just mentioned: impossibility of performance, impracticability of performance, or frustration of purpose. Those don't apply. But if the contract is silent there, there is a body of case law that says that if a party just is prevented from operating their business, then they may have a right to either terminate the contract and get out from under it completely, or possibly suspend performance. Although the case law that I've seen pretty much limits the tenant's right to just a termination of the contract. There isn't very much case law, if any, indicating that you can just suspend performance while you're prevented from operating. So for a lot of tenants in this setting, though, today, they don't want to completely shut their business. They're hoping to come back. And so that may not really provide them with any relief. Another thing that's impacting the rights of tenants under commercial leases are this new SBA program that is going to actually expressly provide tenants with funds to pay their rent for at least a 2-month period. Mm-hmm. So if a tenant's going to try to argue, hey, I can't pay my rent, Mr. Landlord, because the government's forced me to shut down, I've advised my clients who are landlords to tell their tenants they need to go apply for these SBA loan, the payroll protection loan, which actually gives them money to pay their rent for at least 2 months. So under that scenario, they've got an option that would allow them to meet their obligations really at no cost to them, because those SBA payroll protection loans, on paper, those are forgivable to the tenant as long as they use the money for what it's earmarked for. So really, you're basically, the federal government is saying, we're going to pay up to 2 months of rent for you, Mr. Commercial Tenant, if you just apply for this loan. So in that case, there really isn't an excuse for a commercial tenant not to pay their rent.
Boy, a lot of spinning plates, huh? It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out in the courts.
It is. It is. And I've told most of my clients that I really think if you look at this, from 30,000-foot perspective, the law does not favor the tenants in this situation, generally, to try to really give them any relief at all. The case law, as well as these legal doctrines, coupled with the availability of these federal programs, the landlords really, I think, have the best of the argument, in that the tenants really, they're not excused from paying rent legally, probably under the terms of their contracts. These common law doctrines that do not really operate that favorably for the tenant. And plus, the tenants now have the ability to get funding from the federal government to pay their rent for at least 2 months. So I don't think the tenants are going to be in a really strong position trying to argue that somehow their performance is excused. Now, one thing that's impacted this for everybody that does help the tenants, at least in the short term, is the courts are basically shut down. And there also have been in some states, Kentucky's included, they're not allowing any eviction proceedings to proceed for at least a couple of months. And in fact, the latest order from the Kentucky Supreme Court prevents landlords from even filing for an eviction proceeding anytime before the end of May. So basically, there's at least a two-month window here in Kentucky where a landlord, both residential and commercial, are not going to be able to go to court to get any kind of relief if a tenant just thumbs their nose and says, hey, I'm not paying, Mr. Landlord, and there's nothing you can do to me for at least 2 months in terms of getting me evicted from the property. So practically, the tenants at least have got 2 months of occupancy without having to deal with this, although I would caution a tenant against trying to just take a hardline position with a landlord, because I don't believe a tenant, either a commercial tenant or a residential tenant, is going to be able to claim they don't owe the rent for that two-month period. And so you're going to look up in 2 months, and if you haven't paid your rent, you're going to have a substantial arrearage and have to deal with that, or else a landlord very well may be able to evict you, whether you're a residential or a commercial tenant.
Well, the real estate investor Tom Barrack, who is also a very close friend of President Trump's, has said that the American commercial mortgage market is on the brink of collapse. And he's warning of a possible chain reaction of margin calls, mass foreclosures, evictions, and potentially, and I really hate to utter these words, but potentially bank failures.
I think, Tom, that's a legitimate concern, although I think it's a bit premature because it's really going to depend upon how far down the financial food chain this runs. Because just today I was speaking with some of my clients who own some commercial property, and surprisingly, most of their tenants have actually paid April rent. And I think it's because the tenants believe, number one, they can get funding from the government, or number two, they're getting legal advice that tells them that they're not going to be able to avoid these obligations for the most part, and they don't want to risk losing their business and the property. So I think, if in fact that holds true across the economy and people are paying their rent, then the lenders will have the money to service the debt. If they don't, I do know that there's some banks who have already proposed some interest-only terms for some commercial borrowers that I've been involved with, where they've offered to give them 6 months interest only. And in one case, I have someone who the bank offered to basically give them a six-month complete forbearance period on any payments. I'm sure they're going to add the interest to the loan and have them pay it out over time. But I think it's really a little premature to say how far much of an impact this is going to have. I think that's part of why they put that SBA program in place, so a lot of these commercial tenants will have funding to pay their rent so that the lenders will get their mortgage payments, and then the banks and then the other commercial lenders will stay solvent, at least in the short term. In terms of the effect on the commercial real estate market, I think what this is doing right now, though, I can tell from talking to some people, some real estate brokers, commercial brokers, and other investors I deal with, that the deal flow has pretty much come to a stop because it's very difficult, if not impossible, to really put a valuation on a lot of commercial real estate right now. Even apartment buildings, until we see what effect this is going to have on the ability of tenants to pay their rent, occupancy levels, the viability in the commercial context, the viability of a lot of these businesses. I mean, I think everybody's expecting that retail, brick-and-mortar retail, the marginal retail is going to take a hit. We still don't know about restaurants. A lot of restaurants probably are not going to be able to come back from this. So, malls are shut down. The malls were already struggling. So until I think we see what this is going to do to tenancy, rent rates, occupancy levels, there's no way to value commercial real estate right now. So I don't know how you loan against it. I don't know how you negotiate a deal to buy it unless you're just going to bottom fish. So it's basically brought, I think commercial real estate transactions are at are going to stay in a lull for several months until we see how this works out.
Well, with that as a backdrop, I think that after it began to sink in, we were all knocked back on our heels for a while. And after it began to sink in, we began to see ingenuity and an adaptability begin to happen again, as though it's all kind of been dormant, especially adapting to such enormous change has been dormant within our society for a long time, I would say. But are you hearing among your clients that they're thinking this through and they're figuring it out how they're going to survive?
They are. I mean, you know, there's the old adage, necessity is the mother of invention, and that's really where we're at right now. It's a matter of, figure it out or your business is going to die. I know a lot of the restaurants are trying to survive with carry out and curbside, which is all some of them can do. The problem, though, for many businesses, I mean, when you've been ordered to shut down, I've got some fitness clients, I've got some other clients in retail. I mean, when you've ordered to basically shut your doors and you can't service your customers and your revenue goes to zero, I think these government edicts have really put a limit on how much adaptation is available to many business people. But for those that are trying to be ingenious and figure out different ways to operate, at least in the short term, my hat's off to them.
Dan Rose of the Lexington firm Rose, Grash, Kaminish, and Maids. Thank you so much for being with us, Dan.
Tom, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity and be glad to help anybody at any time. Thank you very much.
It's been 10 years since one of the deadliest coal mining disasters in modern history, the explosion at West Virginia's Upper Big Branch mine that claimed 29 lives. Last month, an innovative theater production opened in New York's storied public theater, Coal Country, a play about the real lives of families affected by the tragedy. The coronavirus pandemic forced the early closure of the play, but during its opening week, Jeff Young of the Ohio Valley Resource spoke with the playwrights.
In the play Coal Country, actors address the audience directly from a spare set. They recall the Upper Big Branch disaster and the loss it left behind.
Ambulances galore, fire trucks, police cars, state troopers. And I literally fell to the floor.
I got a video of Corey on my computer. He shot it underground to explain to his girlfriend what he'd done every day. And I sit there. And I cry from time it starts to time it finishes.
The characters are based on real people. Nearly every word of dialogue comes directly from people who worked in the Upper Big Branch mine or who lost family members there. The playwrights, Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen, call it documentary theater. Shortly after the play opened, the husband and wife team invited me to their Brooklyn apartment and settled into a sofa to explain their work process. At first, Blank said, she wondered if she would even get people to agree to talk with her.
I think what happened is that word got around that we were okay after those first few interviews, because then we started sitting down with more and more folks.
I'm from the rural Midwest.
That's Eric Jensen.
And so, like, I immediately related to people kind of on that level. You know, I felt very, even though I'm from Minnesota, I felt very, very connected to West Virginia. And West Virginians are just amazing storytellers anyway, so.
Like, every experience we had sitting with every person we sat down with was incredibly powerful and incredibly eye-opening and incredibly moving. I mean, I learned so much from everyone that we talked to. We learned a lot about coal mining. We learned a lot about humanity as we often do. When we do this kind of project.
My thing about it was I learned a lot about grief. But during the course of doing this, I lost both my dad and my uncle. And I think that was when I finally understood what we were writing and finally understood what it was like to be in that community. And it broke my heart open.
It occurred to me watching this in an audience that I presume is mostly New Yorkers that this is an opportunity to perhaps overcome another divide in the country, which is the strong divide between urban and rural America now. Do you think you're moving the needle on that discussion at all with this work?
I certainly hope so.
That would be a privilege. That would be a privilege to move the needle on that discussion.
I certainly hope so. I think it is a needle that needs to be moved. The things that people say sometimes about the rural working class otherwise really thoughtful people are shocking to me.
You know, people have dignity. People have history. You know, whether you're pro coal or against coal or whatever, coal miners help build this country and they should be treated as such. And right now what they're doing is they're blocking trains with their bodies in order to get their benefits or in order to get their last paycheck. And I just think workers should be treated better than that.
Eric Jensen and Jessica Blank wrote the play Coal Country about the Upper Big Branch disaster. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Jeff Young.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and WEKU. Next week, a new addition to Eastern Standard.
Hello, everybody. I'm happy to be here with our first segment of the Kentucky Songcrafters series.
Singer-songwriter Carla Gover.
The Kentucky Songcrafters is a group of songwriters that I sort of assembled. I called up everybody and asked if they wanted to join a group whose purpose would be to further our own work, maybe make some new fans, to offer our songs to be recorded and covered by national artists, and also to place our music in films and soundtracks and television. And I just wanted to do something like this as a way of helping other Kentucky songwriters, but also of introducing the world to some of the amazing, but perhaps a little bit lesser known, songwriters from here in our state, because Kentucky is full of songwriting talent.
Carla's first guest, her songwriting collaborator and bandmate, Mitch Barrett. Also with us next week, the unmistakable voice of Kentucky writer Silas House on his recent essay in The Atlantic about an out-of-sight, out-of-mind mentality when it comes to rural people in general, Appalachians in particular.
What it comes down to is it's always okay to negate poor people and powerless people. And I think that's what happens again and again, to, you know, question why somebody wants to live in a particular place.
Plus, Rowan County native Bobby Kahn on her debut memoir about surviving a childhood of violent abuse. And EKU psychologists Melinda Moore and Teresa Botts tell us what they've been hearing as Kentuckians adjust in varying degrees to pandemic life and all it entails. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we'd like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.